Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn, and you are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Tuesday, the 5th of October. We have a wonderful guest this hour. The guy is just incredibly well-spoken. He's so knowledgeable about a variety of issues and is extremely prolific. Historian Julian Zelizer is joining us this hour. His latest book is Jimmy Carter, and the timing is right for this show because, of course, Jimmy Carter released his papers. Some of those were released. He is building a house, Habitat for Humanity, in Washington. He was in the hospital for a couple days last week. And Julian has written about his short presidency, the expectations that he had, what happened with his presidency, and in some recent pieces, including one in the New York Times just in the last week, he talks about President Obama and some of the problems that Obama is having with his personality and public persona. The cool demeanor, Julian says, which served him so well on the campaign trail, has become somewhat of a liability in the time of crisis. In this respect, he faces similar challenges that Jimmy Carter confronted in the 1970s. So we'll do that comparison during the course of this hour. His book is Jimmy Carter. It is part of that wonderful series from Times Books that it's a nice collection to have because I love the presidents and it covers all of the presidents. Julian is the author or editor of 9 books, including Arsenal of Democracy, The Politics of National Security from World War II to the War on Terrorism. He's a professor of history and public affairs at Princeton, a regular contributor to CNN.com, The New York Times, Politico, and other media, joins us frequently and is a terrific guest. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. Our email address is talk@wpr.org. talk@wpr.org. Professor Julian Zelizer, hello. Nice to have you on the show again.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Yeah. Let's start with Jimmy Carter in the last couple weeks because, you know, a bulk of Jimmy Carter, he was out of the presidency at 56 and he's now 86 years old, so we know him since he's been president, but you got to give the guy credit. Building a house for Habitat for Humanity when you're 86 years old after you just got out of the hospital.
Absolutely. I mean, you know, he's been very active even with this hospital stay, both domestically in terms of Habitat for Humanity with North Korea. He has continued, you know, this rather remarkable but controversial post-presidential life, which I think many Americans now, younger Americans, know him for more than his presidency.
Mm-hmm. I didn't know the genesis of his interest in fair elections because he's done a good deal of that since he left the presidency. You write about this in this book. It has to do with one of his elections.
Yeah, when he ran for the Georgia State Senate in 1962, really his entrance into politics. He found himself involved in an incredibly corrupt election, and he was facing an opponent who was supported by the local machine, and the local machine did everything in its power to win. They had people at the ballot box intimidating voters, making sure that if they didn't vote for their candidate, they understood there would be retribution, and he ends up ordering and forcing a recount, Jimmy Carter. So that he ultimately won the election. So he took on kind of a corrupt machine, a classic Southern political operation, and won right at the start of his career. And I think, you know, some of the experience and some of what he saw, it really shocked him, has continued to influence him through this day.
Mm-hmm. You talk about his being an outsider, which you know, he really was, this Southern politician, peanut farmer. Being an outsider, both a blessing and a curse for Jimmy Carter. How so?
Well, he always was an outsider whenever he was involved in elected office. And, you know, even when he was in Georgia and before he starts his national political career, he had the same kind of dynamic. On the one hand, he campaigned as someone who is not beholden to the interest groups. He takes on the Democratic establishment in this early 1962 campaign. When he's in office, he refuses to do what a Democrat is supposed to do. He's willing to anger key interest groups in his own state. And so that's part of his appeal. It's part of what people liked about Jimmy Carter. We hear about outsiders, but we don't actually see them very often, and he was one.
Mm-hmm.
But when in office, that became a problem. In Georgia, for example, when he was governor, he hated dealing with the state legislature. He hated having them over and having to kind of wine and dine them. He doesn't follow the normal rituals of being obsequious to them. And early on, they really don't like him very much. And what happens is it's hard for him to build strong political coalitions. Because the very quality that people like on election day is not so helpful once you have to, you know, maintain yourself in office.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk about race in Jimmy Carter, because he's coming out of the South here. What he learned about race from his dealings, particularly with his mother and his family, Southern racism, and then I want to talk a little bit about some of the things he said during the campaign, which were fairly outrageous. Where were his views on race? Where were they developed?
In general, he is a kind of more progressive Southerner, part of what was called the New South. You know, Southerners were more interested in rebuilding the region economically than focusing on the old fault lines of politics and race. His mother is very progressive on racial issues, much more so than his father, and worked, you know, as a nurse in the African American community, and was very dismissive of a lot of the old kind of racial rituals that Southerners followed. And I think that clearly influenced Jimmy Carter. And as he developed and matured, you know, he also was not one of the old hardline Southern segregationists, and he made that very much part of his appeal. When he runs for governor, this is something that is at the forefront of what he says once he wins office. There are moments, though, when he will accept, you know, endorsements from people who were seen as supporting segregation. And there are some statements that have been interpreted to show early on in his career, at least, he was not above, you know, old-fashioned race baiting. But in general, I still see him as part of the New South, and I think he was pretty genuine in wanting to kind of move toward a new kind of race relations.
What about the comment that he made, which I wasn't aware of, in the 76 race about busing?
Yeah, he makes an extremely controversial statement about busing, kind of indicating that he was sympathetic or understood the arguments of people who wanted their neighborhoods to be kind of preserved or wanted their children to go to the same kind of school. And he talks about, you know, some kind of sympathy toward ethnic purity. I think the statement didn't capture what he wanted to say. It blows up during the primaries, and some use it to suggest this is a Southerner who's not so different after all. I think it was more clumsy Carter and awkward Carter, trying to talk to kind of white Democrats, working class Democrats, at the same time he was trying to forge this kind of new Southern appeal.
Mm-hmm. And place him in history. If the time was ripe for there to be an outsider, it was certainly the time that he ran. We had been through Watergate in this country. It was horrendous. We needed somebody who had sort of this moral sensibility about him.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, again, here's a guy who his whole career he had crafted this outsider image and this outsider style of politics. That's what he was about, and he was really good at it. And then when he finally runs for president in 1976, it's the perfect time for that kind of political campaign. America has just been shattered by both Vietnam, but also by Watergate in 1974. You know, the resignation of a president is something most Americans have not lived through. And the sense our politics were corrupt, that we couldn't trust our political leaders, was really widespread in that year. And here comes Carter during that campaign, and his central promise is not about policy. It's that you could trust him, mm-hmm. that he would, you know, keep his promises, and he would run a different kind of politics. So he was a perfectly timed candidate for that election.
I had forgotten how many people were in that race. There were a lot of Democrats, weren't there?
Yeah, it's a pretty remarkable primary, and I think it contradicts the idea he's some inept politician. I mean,
yes,
he runs against some really heavy-hitting Democrats, entrenched people like Henry Scoop Jackson or like Birch Bayh, Indiana senator, people who were well-known, who had a lot of resources, and even Jerry Brown, actually, at the end of the campaign. And he really plays the whole primary and caucus process perfectly. For example, he takes the Iowa caucus seriously. It's early on. No one ever campaigned there. No one took it seriously. And he said, if I campaign there and I win, the media will start talking about me as a winner. And it doesn't matter if it doesn't count for many delegate votes. And he does that. And it really kind of launches his primary race.
Isn't that interesting? And many years later, it does the same thing for Barack Obama.
Absolutely. The importance of Iowa. As I watched Barack Obama and his strategy, there were a lot of resemblances in terms of kind of how he appealed to the media, how he mastered the caucus process. And this was all new. Remember, the whole caucus primary system had been around for a while, but it hadn't been central until the reforms of 1972, which kind of broke the old smoke-filled room convention process where party bosses had selected the winner. So Carter is ahead of his time in understanding not just the impact of Watergate, but how the selection process had changed. And he plays it perfectly.
And showing, again, his political savvy, he leaves Iowa, so he's not there. He's in New York, so the major media can talk to him about his victory.
Absolutely. And again, you know, there's all these stories I found while writing this book where he was much more sophisticated than people thought at the time. So, you know, when he wins, he doesn't stay there. He goes where the major media market is and where all the reporters will be so that they can talk to him in person and that they can, you know, really get him on the front pages and on the television network. You know, even when he finally wins the nomination, he's dressed in rather formal clothes when he finds out, and he changes, and he puts on that jean jacket, which is kind of a famous image, in part because he realizes that if he goes on, he is now the establishment. He's
right.
Now the leader, and he had to preserve some of the image which was going to bring him to the presidency.
I didn't realize that the race was that close.
Yeah, the race is very close against Jerry Ford, and you know Ford is the kind of replacement of Richard Nixon, had not been elected, but you know it's a kind of neck and neck race. Carter does pretty well, but in October his polls start to slip, and it really goes down to the wire. It's one of the closest elections that we had in American history. So Carter wins, but he barely wins.
And we'll talk about what happens when he gains the presidency and how he's pretty strong in the first year, and then what happens in terms of the economy and all kinds of issues, Iran, his work with Begin and Anwar Sadat and the peace meetings and energy issues and all of that coming up. And welcome your phone calls. Our lines are all filled already. You really want to talk about Jimmy Carter, so that's good. We'll start your calls momentarily. Julian Zelizer is our guest. His latest book is Jimmy Carter. Our phone number, 800-486-8655. The email, talk@WPR.org. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We go to phone calls now for Julian Zelizer, starting with John in Milwaukee. Hi, John.
Hi. One of the few things that I remember from the Carter presidency was that the failures that got attached to him were related to the price of oil skyrocketing during his term, and then the other one would have been the Iranian hostages, and then a third one would have been just inflation in general. And what I'm wondering is how much of the actual price of fuel and inflation were actually related to the Carter administration. He seemed to have been blamed for it. But if I'm not mistaken, a couple of years prior to that, President Nixon had taken the U.S. off the gold standard. And I think what was happening, in my opinion, was that you were seeing the oil companies or the oil nations responding to that the U.S. dollar was no longer backed by gold, and that caused the inflation that occurred during Jimmy Carter's administration, and also caused the price of fuel to go up. And actually during that time, I was in college, and there actually was a gas shortage, because I remember there were gas stations that would shut down.
Yes, I remember that, too.
And there was absolutely no gas at all.
Mm-hmm.
But I think he got blamed for it. But in reality, he was a leader in the sense that part of one of the first things Ronald Reagan did when he came to office was he removed solar collectors that Jimmy Carter had put up on the White House.
All right, Professor Zelizer.
Yeah, I mean, there were many routes to the energy crisis, from things that were going on in the U.S. Oil industry in the late 60s when they already knew there was going to be a shortage of fuel in this country. Also, the OPEC embargo, the first one in 1973, and the second one will happen in 1979. And it will leave, you know, people literally and famously waiting in line for fuel. And there are kind of iconic images. Many people remember those lines when they remember the 1970s. There was also stagflation, which was the combination of inflation and unemployment at the same time. So he governed in this period where there was a horrible economy. It doesn't really get much better during his presidency. It's not his fault. But at the same time, he's unable to solve it. And the energy, he is, I think, at the forefront of a lot of the issues that we talk about today. From the first year in his presidency, he pushes very hard for all sorts of energy reform, from more use of solar power to higher taxes, to diminish the use of certain kinds of energy. He only gets some of it during his presidency. But in terms of putting it on the agenda, laying out the issues that this country faced, I think, you know, it's one of the more interesting and important parts of his presidency.
It's also rather depressing to realize how important it was then and has continued to be important over all the subsequent presidencies, and how little we've addressed this incredibly important issue.
Oh, absolutely. And in 1977, he says, you know, that the energy crisis is the moral equivalent of war. And that this is something that the nation was going to have to face and resolve, or it would continue to be a problem. And he really does, again, lay out the kinds of problems we're still dealing with today, and it shows this area of policy is pretty intractable. Again, he made some gains, but this is not something that either Democrats or Republicans were very interested in solving.
Yeah, and let's talk a little bit more about the economy, and I'd like to do a little bit of comparison to now in a moment. What was going on with unemployment, with inflation during his presidency? What caused the incredibly high inflation? I think the unemployment rate was fairly high as well.
Yeah, both were very high, and this was a kind of change that had been going on since the mid-60s. You know, some people pin it to the government spending for Vietnam. You know, inflation really starts to kick in 66 and 67 when Lyndon Johnson's budgets are increasing. Some of the stagnation that's causing unemployment is that, you know, the U.S. industry is starting to suffer in competition with West Germany and with Japan. And we're not having this kind of innovations that we were hoping for. By the end of Carter's presidency, we have tight monetary policy. Paul Volcker is appointed as the head of the Federal Reserve by Carter, and he really clamps down on inflation by clamping down on the economy. And Carter, I mean, this, he has a lot of areas we can talk about where he has pretty bold policies, from energy to human rights. But the economy is not one of them, and he kind of is resigned to a rather mild stimulus program with some public work spending, but he's never very eager to spend a lot on that area. And I think it really hurt him and hurt him politically, because many Democrats felt that was what he really needed to focus on.
In a piece that you wrote recently for the New York Times, September 28th, you're doing some comparison between Obama and Carter. Part of the problem, you say, of Obama has to do with his personality and his cool demeanor. He has trouble winning over voters, angry, scared, and frustrated about the state of the economy. In this respect, he does face similar challenges that Jimmy Carter confronted in the 1970s. In bad economic times, you don't want somebody who's professorial and clinical about the problems of the day. You want somebody who's going to save you.
Yeah, and that was a problem Carter had. And again, to draw some comparisons, in the campaign of 76, he was terrific. You know, he really knew what the public was feeling, and his speeches came off very well, and he understood kind of the symbols that he needed to use in the post-Watergate age. But when he went on television and would make speeches about either energy or, more importantly, about the economy, he constantly came off to many voters as someone who was lecturing them about what was wrong with them, rather than offering some kind of vision, some kind of leadership. This is most famous in the speech he makes in July 1979, where he talks about the crisis of confidence in this nation. He had worked on it for many days in Camp David, and he wants this to be a major address, not just about energy, but about where the country was in late 1970s America. And over time, people come to remember that speech as exactly what was wrong with Jimmy Carter, not was what was right. Instead of saying, I'm going to do this, I'm going to kind of move us beyond these problems, he was saying, this is the problem you have, this is the problem the nation has, and you will have to deal with it. And it didn't come off well, even if he was often right. As with energy, the problem wasn't simply government policy. The problem was our own use of resources.
Jim in Milwaukee, hi.
Oh, good morning, Kathleen, and to your guest. I'd like to go back to the economic situation. I think there are many parallels between the economy of President Carter due to his economic policies and the shape the economy is in now. For one thing, President Carter hired an economist named Alfred Kahn, I believe is his name, and under his advice, Mr. Carter deregulated. That's a euphemism for what he did to the airlines and trucking industries. He destroyed tens and tens of thousands of good union-paying jobs that had great benefits. And that pretty much marks the beginning of the attack on the American working class by the Democrat Party, which just accentuated much more through the Clinton era with these trade treaties with China and these other countries, and NAFTA and GATT and all that. And it's developed such a headwind, I don't know that any of these policies can be stopped.
Okay, let's get a response. Julian?
I think that's a great point. I mean, yes, Carter is responsible for the legislation that deregulates the airline industry. And he's one of the early, you know, we think of deregulation as a Republican policy, but in the 1970s, Carter supported it, and he pushes through the legislation that actually starts the whole process. There's also liberals like Ted Kennedy, who is a big proponent of deregulation from the perspective of a consumer. But it's during this presidency that we see a shift away from the New Deal, Great Society policies, which really still centered on stronger government regulations toward freeing markets. And I think some say we're still living now with the consequences of what happened. And he also creates major risks with working class Democrats, not just with deregulation, but with other kinds of decisions, such as abandoning national health care, not spending enough on public works. And by 1980, Ted Kennedy, the senator, is actually, he will challenge Carter in the primaries. And that's one of his major arguments, that Carter is a centrist Democrat who has abandoned the voters who made the Democratic Party and the ideas that had animated the party. And that in some ways, you know, thinking ahead, he was a Clintonian Democrat. And I think that rift, which we're still talking about today, was quite important.
Mm-hmm. It is amazing that Kennedy decided to take him on, isn't it?
Oh, absolutely. And you know, Kennedy never really liked Carter. And personally, they didn't get along very well. But where they really have a break is over health care. You know, Kennedy is a proponent of a national health care system, a kind of clean system where the government will provide insurance and everyone will essentially pitch in, a Social Security model. And Carter doesn't want that and doesn't think it can pass, and pushes for a much more incremental kind of jerry-built approach toward health care, and he doesn't push very hard for it. And when Kennedy sees that he's not going to follow through on this, the relationship really deteriorates. And by it's in 1978 already that Kennedy, you know, a major Democrat, is openly and publicly railing against the administration. And he makes a speech to Democrats in December of 1978 where he says Carter is just moving so far to the center that he's undermining the party. And he says that sometimes, you know, politicians need to sail against the wind, meaning that they can't just, you know, give in to the conservative pressures that they were facing. And that's a very damaging rift, I think, to Carter and his success and failure.
Thanks, Jim. We have some lines open now. They've been crowded, but the number, if you would like to use it to get through right now, is 800-486-8655. And our email address is talk@WPR.org. Rich in Rhinelander. Hi, Rich.
Good morning, and guest. I maintain Jimmy Carter was probably our last serious president and our last truly conservative president. He came into office on the cusp of mean politics. Jerry Cherniak at ABC News and Frank Reynolds, Ted Koppel started this business about American held hostage. His successor, Ronald Reagan, is labeled as a conservative. But if you write down on paper in two columns the policies that Jimmy Carter was pursuing and the policies that Ronald Reagan pursued, I mean, I want Jimmy Carter to be my best friend, but all my friends would warn me, well, if you invite him to your house to dinner, everybody's going to fall asleep at the table. If you invite Ronald Reagan to dinner, everybody's going to leave jovial and laughing. But Ronald Reagan says things like, I've signed legislation outlawing the Soviet Union. I begin bombing in 5 minutes. I don't worry about the deficit. It's big enough to take care of itself. And even long before he had the symptoms of Alzheimer's, Ronald Reagan goes to a school and introduces himself and says to the young man in front of him, I'm sorry, I don't know your name. And the kid says, I'm Mike, I'm your son. And he says, oh, I didn't recognize you. Now, Jimmy Carter is labeled as a failure president, Ronald Reagan as a success. Jimmy Carter was a religiously, economically, he was a capitalist farmer, true traditional primal conservative. Ronald Reagan, in my opinion, came into office on the cusp of the politics of mean, and he had the personality to sustain it into our current crisis.
Professor Zelizer.
Well, there's a lot of issues there. I mean, on the kind of seriousness of presidents, that's a debate, you know, everyone could probably have. There's many people who think Reagan was a very serious conservative, kind of an idea-driven president, actually. But that's, you know, I can't resolve that debate. But in terms of Carter's conservatism, that's true. You know, there were many issues where Carter differed with the Democratic Party. On the deficit, he was very concerned about balancing the budget and thought that should be a priority often over spending commitments and spending needs. He was also very interested in the reorganization of government, and he was also, you know, very interested in fighting the power of interest groups on Capitol Hill, which at that time really leaned toward the Democratic Party. You know, I owe the special interest nothing, was one of his campaign themes in 1976. On foreign policy, I think he was more liberal than the caller suggests. You know, one of his big initiatives is human rights, and there are conservatives who supported human rights, but Carter really extended an agenda of human rights into parts of the world that didn't really fit with what we were trying to do with the Cold War. And this infuriated many conservatives in places like Latin America. So he's a complex figure. There are areas where he is genuinely and very conservative, others where he continued the liberal tradition and in some ways tried to extend it to foreign policy.
Yeah, and let's spend a few moments here on foreign policy, because when you think of Jimmy Carter, you think of Iran, and you think of Begin and Sadat, certainly, as well. So let's start with Iran, which was the undoing of his presidency.
Well, I think his presidency is already, you know, on thin ice by the time Iran happens and the hostages are taken. And I think, you know, part of the reason it goes badly politically is because already no one really supports him and trusts him. But clearly it was a huge crisis. The hostages are taken. Americans are watching on television every night and seeing, you know, how long this crisis has gone on. Carter was very determined not to use military force, and then he focuses on a kind of backroom negotiating process, which he's very committed to, and in the end actually works. But the public doesn't see that, doesn't like it, and instead they see a president trapped in the White House in 1980, not appearing to do anything about these hostages that are being held. So it continued and accelerated images that had existed already by that time of Carter as this incompetent president who was not forceful, who was not an effective leader.
Mm-hmm.
But ironically, he does solve it. I mean, you know, the last day of his presidency, he does work out a deal that frees them. And in the end, Reagan will get credit because the Iranians won't free the hostages until Reagan's inaugurated as a kind of slap in the face to Carter.
And did he help to make any significant progress in the Middle East? Go ahead.
Absolutely. I mean, the accord between the Egyptians and the Israelis, which I think is, you know, the most successful peace initiative we've had in the Middle East, is hatched in Camp David between Sadat and Begin, and Carter plays a really big role during what were very tense meetings. And he leans both on Begin, but also on Sadat, who he really liked and was much friendlier with, but really leans on both of them and plays an important role during those days in working out some kind of agreement. And that agreement, with all the problems, has lasted now for many decades. And I think it remains a model of what people should be aspiring to. So that was really a great area of success for him.
Why did he like Sadat so much?
Everyone liked Sadat at the time. He was a very charismatic, kind of cosmopolitan leader. He was seen as the person pushing the peace initiative. He makes a famous trip to Israel the first time, and he speaks to the Knesset. And so Carter, I think, liked that as well. He didn't like Begin. Comes through again and again. Part of it, Begin was a very tough guy, not, you know, a very personally nice or warm person. And then part of it, you know, and this is the big question, reflects just a bias, if it does reflect a bias against Israel that he had. But he was just enamored with Sadat like many other leaders were. Mm. But he is very important in the negotiation.
Mm-hmm. Thanks, Rich. We go to Daniel in Rice Lake. Hi.
Hello. After the Soviet Union invaded Afghanistan, and we're still suffering the repercussions today, fear was that it was a step towards conquering the oil-rich Gulf. Carter said in an address to the nation that we would resort to nuclear weapons if the Soviet Union continued towards the Gulf. Was Carter capable of ordering the use of nuclear weapons to stop the Soviet Union?
The Soviet invasion of Afghanistan is I think it's in some ways as important as the hostages in Iran. And when the Soviets invade, he's really taken by surprise in some ways, Carter, because he was fighting at the time just as the context for SALT II, another round of arms agreements with the Soviet Union. And when the Soviets invade in December, of 1980, of 1979, he's just let down. He feels like the Soviets are not serious about detente. They're not serious anymore about negotiation. And he realizes politically it's a disaster for him. And he orders a rather kind of bold increase in our military posture. He outlines a new kind of vision of U.S. forces in the Persian Gulf, which will in fact remain what we have today, and a big increase in defense spending. I don't think he was ready to use nuclear weapons against the Soviet Union, but he is willing to kind of ramp up our defense posture in a way he hadn't been until that moment. And he also realizes that for the time being, any more discussions about SALT II are over. Mm-hmm. And he puts it aside. He realizes that in the Senate, after the Soviets invaded, there was just no way he would get support for this anymore.
Thanks, Daniel. A couple lines are open if you'd like to join our conversation. Professor Julian Zelizer is with us this hour, and his latest book is Jimmy Carter. It's part of the American President series published by Times Books. Julian is the author or editor of a number of books, including most recently Arsenal of Democracy, The Politics of National Security from World War II to the War on Terrorism. He's a professor of history and public affairs at Princeton University, and he is a prolific writer. He contributes to CNN.com, The New York Times, Politico, and many other media. So we welcome your phone calls. Join us by email if you'd like. That is talk@WPR.org. And this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. And our next phone call is Cindy in Milwaukee. Hi, Cindy.
Yeah, hi.
Hi.
I have an observation, and then I'd like to know what his comments would be on it. It seems to me that there's not enough dialogue today about what it means for us to become a global economy and the impact that it's having on domestic policy as well as international policy. And I'm just wondering if some of the efforts of Jimmy Carter in the early days toward deregulation and even during Clinton's time, were those kinds of considerations, that corporations have taken over what that whole issue means and are controlling it, but that they're really looking at enabling small companies in foreign countries to have some impact, things like that. I just wonder what he would say about this, and that we are no longer isolated. We're not in any way isolated when it comes to our economy.
I think with Carter, his primary concern with deregulation, with the airline industry in particular, was, to help consumers and to weaken interest groups. Like many liberals at the time, not just conservatives, there was a belief that regulation had not worked, because basically the industries that were regulated were the ones who benefited, and that the consumers were the ones who paid a high price. And Carter very much believed this, and he didn't distinguish between corporate interest groups and organized labor. He kind of saw them all as a bigger problem in Washington. Kennedy, who supported the deregulation, was very concerned and believed that if there was more choice, consumers would have just a much better situation in terms of flight options. So I think that was what drove him at the time, and I think conservative deregulation had a very different flavor in the 1980s through today. In terms of the international economy, this was happening then. I mean, the pressures from countries like Japan and West Germany were very strong, and the sense that America was no longer competing was very strong. But some of the issues we face today in terms of kind of businesses just relocating abroad, I don't think were on the radar as much as they are today. I'm not sure Carter would have had an answer. Again, he was not a very strong president when it came to tackling the economic problems that afflicted the nation.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much for your call, Cindy. And we have lines open if you'd like to join the conversation. The number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Our email address is talk@WPR.org. Referencing again that New York Times article, what the president perhaps needs to learn from Jimmy Carter's presidency and his inability to be elected for a second term. You wrote in the Times article that President Obama needs to rethink his economic policies. In the end, this is what will make the greatest difference for his reelection prospects in 2012. Like Obama, Carter complained that the public didn't appreciate his policy accomplishments and that they weren't hearing the messages that he delivered. But when he failed to resolve the biggest problem confronting the nation, economic malaise, voters were in no mood to listen. There are a lot of parallels here, aren't there?
Kind of when you look, I remember reading the kind of first years of Carter, and he was always boasting of his legislative record as well. And there were comparisons he made to Lyndon Johnson, and he said the public wasn't appreciating this. I mean, I think for me there's two important lessons. One is the economy, and that ultimately, you know, if you don't solve that core issue, all the other accomplishments politically fade away. And so it's not enough to just point people toward what you did. I think you have to solve what's, you know, on the top of the list for most voters. The second is that one of Carter's great failures was his inability to build a strong base of support in the Democratic Party. It wasn't something that interested him, and he's admitted it in recent weeks, that he didn't really like being a party leader. He liked being president, but presidents are party leaders. And so as he damaged his relations with congressional Democrats like Speaker Tip O'Neill, who never liked him, or Senator Kennedy, I think he found himself in a politically vulnerable situation by the late 70s when conservatives started to really attack him and these crises hit. He had no one to turn to.
Yeah.
And I think there's a little of that has happened with Obama. It's still earlier in his presidency, but we see some of the outlines of that kind of problem.
Mm-hmm. Let's go to Lucille in Delavan. Hi, Lucille.
Hi. Hi. Okay. Do you know how Jimmy Carter has stayed so vital and active in his you know, 80s?
86. Yeah.
Well, if I had the answer to that, I could probably, you know, make a lot of money because we would all take that medicine. I don't know physically. I mean, his mother lived a very long and vigorous life. But, you know, intellectually, you know, this is someone who's always very engaged. He's not a politician. I think that's part of the answer. I mean, he genuinely cares about the various issues that he has taken on. And I think that has sustained him. You know, his kind of belief that the Carter Center could become a real showcase for dealing with international problems, I think, you know, wakes him up every day and makes him excited, even in the face of great controversy, about dealing with these issues. And I also think he's happier when he's not a politician. I think since his presidency, he was freed from the kind of, you know, decisions he had to make about what was politically right and what was politically wrong. He was freed from being accountable to a political party. And I think that brought him to life in certain ways and is something that he enjoys very much.
I loved his mother's spunk, and I'm sure a lot of others did as well, going into the Peace Corps at a, you know, elderly age, and she was fun.
She was fun. She was very influential, and Carter used her in his campaign.
Yes,
I mean,
right.
He made her part of his story, which was something he was very good at, by the way, in his kind of presidential run and gubernatorial run, using his biography as one of his best assets. And his mother was part of that story, and she's someone a lot of the public who lived through that period remembers, which we can't say for most of the parents of the president.
Right. Judy, thanks, Lucille. Judy in Milwaukee, hi.
Hi. I've been spending the last 11 days at the Milwaukee Film Festival, and Bhutto was one of the documentary films, and it was about Benazir Bhutto. And it didn't paint a very good picture of President Carter. It was information that I wasn't familiar with, but in essence said that we were involved in deposing Benazir Bhutto's father as prime minister, and even had Zbigniew Brzezinski in it, sitting next to five Taliban people, saying these are like our founding fathers, and spoke of his involvement in support of the Taliban. I wonder if you could talk to me a bit about, and all of us, about Jimmy Carter's policy towards democracy in Pakistan and toward the Taliban in Afghanistan.
Well, there's different. I mean, Carter was not perfectly consistent either. And, you know, he launches this big human rights agenda from 1977 onwards, and he makes it part of formal State Department policy to rank different countries based on their human rights policies and make that part of you know, how we treat and interact and trade with other countries. You know, he tries to throw his support toward certain human rights movements in certain parts of the world. But at the same time, there's countries where he didn't live up to that. A country that has become famous for this recently is Indonesia, where his policies were very weak in terms of human rights.
and he wasn't abiding by what he said. Conservatives criticized Carter, by the way, for not being tough enough with the Soviet Union and in the pursuit of detente, being willing to ignore the flagrant human rights violations that were taking place. So this is actually a very old criticism from the left and the right. The left that he wasn't consistent, the right that he was softer on communist regimes or socialist regimes than he was on other kinds of authoritarian governments. And my only answer is that there were inconsistencies in some of these areas. And obviously with the kind of fight against the Soviet Union in Afghanistan, this was a process that would continue throughout the 1980s, where we were working with some of the groups who since then have become, our biggest enemies.
Mm. Sounds like an interesting film, Judy.
It was amazing. Of course, there were so many that were, but I'd say that was way up there with my top 10.
Uh-huh. Thank you so much for your call.
You.
Uh-huh. Irv in Black River Falls. Hi.
Well, thank you very much. I heard on the radio the other day somebody had credited Jimmy Carter with deregulating the trucking industry, and I always thought it was Ronald Reagan. Can you clear that up for me? I'll hang up and take it off.
All right, Irv.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think we had a caller started that. The deregulation of airlines, of the trucking industry, all that really starts in the 1970s. The one where Reagan really, I think, moves most aggressively is on the telecommunications industry. But even that, most policies bubble up and are being worked on by administrations early on. And Carter had a hand in almost, all the major deregulatory initiatives that we had.
I don't know if I've asked you this before, but I'm glad you wrote this book about Jimmy Carter, and I know you've done one on George W. Bush, the first historical assessment. Here you are, a historian, and you've spent a lot of time, and I love reading about the presidents. Are there several who you just are endless? My guy is Lincoln, and I make no secrets about that. I could read about him for the rest of my life and never exhaust my interest in him. Are there presidents who do that for you, too, that you could just read about endlessly?
Yeah, I've read a lot. Lyndon Johnson, for me, is that kind of president, and FDR is that kind of president. I've worked on them, I've read about them, and I'm continuously fascinated with them. Carter is not, I would say, at the top of my list in terms of that, but I actually became more interested in him and what he did and the kind of legacies he had as a result of writing the book. But there are certain presidents I think we all have who really just capture our attention.
Right. Let's go to Ann in Madison. Hi, Ann.
Hi. Well, there's a book entitled Trilateralism, The Trilateral Commission and Elite Planning for World Management. It was published in 1980. It was edited by Holly Sklar, who was a grad student at Columbia then. And on the back of the book, it says, what do Jimmy Carter, John Anderson, George Bush, Zbigniew Brzezinski, Henry Kissinger, Cyrus Vance, Walter Mondale, and Andrew Young have in common with David Rockefeller? Answer, the Trilateral Commission, and members also include the top executives of Exxon, General Motors, Ford, Coca-Cola, Bank of America, Cargill, Bechtel, General Electric, CBS, Time, Barclays Bank, Rio Tinto, Mitsubishi, Kitsait, and the heads of the Republican National Committee, the AFL-CIO, the Federal Reserve Board, the Council on Foreign Relations, Georgetown University Center for Strategic and International Studies, the Bilderberg Group, the Prime Minister of France, the British Secretary of State, the West German Minister of Economics, the Japanese Minister for Foreign Affairs. It's really a fascinating compendium of exactly where the idea of so-called globalization began, and I wondered if Professor Zelizar would talk about trilateralism.
Sure.
Well, the Trilateral Commission was a group of, everything from experts such as Brzezinski to politicians, former and future politicians, to other kinds of leaders, all of which were mentioned in that list. And there's many people in the Carter presidency, including Carter, who had participated in it. I think sometimes it's given this conspiracy flavor when it was really just more like a think tank that did very well and had prominent people. But the point of the commission was to, again, try to move beyond stale Cold War arguments about international relations to try to understand new directions in which the world was moving, new kinds of alliances and new kinds of problems that were faced, like human rights issues. And so, yes, it did have a big influence. But again, I just see it as more of one of the many think tanks or networks that form that eventually triggers discussions that lead to public policy changes.
Mm-hmm. And one more phone call. It has to be brief. Doug in Madison. Hi. Hi, Doug.
Hello.
Yes, Doug. Go ahead, please.
I just had a question about the housing boom. The conservatives like to say that it started with Jimmy Carter, and I'll take my answer off the air. Thank you.
I'm not sure what the question is. I mean, the housing boom really starts, if you want to be accurate, with Truman and Eisenhower. It's in the 40s and 50s we start to see the mass development of suburban homes, which I think is the trajectory to today. So I wouldn't pin Carter on that development, even though obviously there's certain acceleration that takes place.
Yeah. Well, thank you once again for an entirely fascinating article, for the book and for the hour of conversation. It was great. Thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah, Professor Julian Zelizer, I am referencing, and it is an interesting article in the New York Times if you want to go to the September 28 Address the Economic Malaise, his advice to President Obama. His latest book is Jimmy Carter, part of the American President series, published by Times Books. And we thank him very much for being with us. He's a professor of history at Princeton University, and his most latest book before this, not his most latest, his latest, is Arsenal of Democracy, The Politics of National Security from World War II to the War on Terrorism. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing the hour, to Chrissy Pease for on-air production here in our studios in beautiful downtown Milwaukee. We'll be with you again tomorrow at 9 on the Ideas Network.